Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to have iconic American actor, producer, and activist Richard Dreyfuss joining us in studio today. Known for his role in the film American Graffiti and hits like Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Richard Dreyfuss received an Oscar in 1978 for Best Actor in The Goodbye Girl. While drug addiction derailed his career for a time, Dreyfuss made a comeback in the 1980s, starting with his performance in the 1986 movie Down and Out in Beverly Hills, and with additional hits like Stakeout, always with Holly Hunter, as well as What About Bob. In 1995, Dreyfuss was nominated for both an Academy Award and a Golden Globe for his performance in the musical drama Mr. Holland's Opus. More recently, Dreyfuss portrayed Vice President Dick Cheney in Oliver Stone's film W, about the life of George W. Bush, and appeared on the TV shows Weeds and Parenthood. While continuing to act, Dreyfuss has also become politically active and spends his time championing individual rights. He appeared in a 2007 documentary on youth voting, 18 in 08, and encourages teaching American history to children in elementary school. Welcome, Richard Dreyfuss. What an honor it is to have you here.
Yes, it is.
Great.
Thank you.
It's so good to have you. Well, we have a lot to pack into an hour. I've come to know you as a guy who has some very specific political views, as well as we're going to ask you all about the films. So why not start with an op-ed piece that you've originally constructed and tell us what's in it and why you wrote it?
I was saying that the country is in a conflict that's the worst since the 1850s. And I reminded people that whenever we do a national endeavor, it starts out with glitches and everything falls apart. Like World War II didn't start very well.
It didn't.
And neither did the highway system or the Social Security Act or any of those. And what happens is that these things are fixed by a combination of both parties who get together and fix them, which is what should happen now. The problem is that the Republicans have become known as against health care. And that means that if they succeed in stopping the health care plan, that the sick, dying, and dead will be on their lawns. And I don't think they want that. And the Republican Party right now, when I ask them, would you allow anyone in your party to be called a moderate? And they said, no. And I said, well, doesn't that mean that you're all extremist and your party is an extremist party and you're doomed? And they didn't answer and they got up and left, including the woman who invented the Tea Party. So I believe in a phrase that comes from another issue, in background checks. I think the Congress should have background checks. I think they should have schooling while they're in Congress, and not one of them, at least in the far right of the Republican Party, knows anything about the Constitution. And when Robert Dole, who was wounded viciously in World War II, was brought to the well of the Senate, Santorum got up and killed the Disabled Veterans Act right in front of a disabled veteran hero. And then he picked up the Constitution and said, this is a Christian nation. And I wanted to call him and say, I will bet you $1 million that that is nowhere in the Constitution. And it ain't. What I am is not a Democrat. I am pre-partisan. I believe the way George Washington believed, which is the Constitution should be central and the parties peripheral. I can be against the Democrats or the Republicans, and I can praise both because I believe in a two-party system. But the Republicans of late have lost their minds, and they could at any time shut up the Tea Party. And they're not doing it because of television ads financed by the Koch brothers. And sooner or later, someone in the moderate Republican majority is going to stand up and say, there are 100 legislative ways of shutting these people up, and he will become a hero, and he will be the nominee.
Let's go back to your beginnings, Richard Dreyfuss. You were born where, and what were your parents like?
I like to say that I was born not in 1947, but in 1881, which is where the stories come to me that really shaped my moral character. My great aunt assassinated Tsar Alexander II in 1883, I think.
How do we know that?
I have two cousins who are both federal judges, and I had lunch and I asked them. And by the time they got back to their office and I got back to my house, they had two confirming opinions. My aunt was a member of the Narodniki, the Narodnaya Volya, which means the will of the people. And she was the only one who was not killed because she was pregnant, and even the Okhrana did not kill a pregnant woman. And so she came to New York, and her brother got a job in the sanitation department, and they wore uniforms, you know. So my great-aunt didn't talk to her brother for a decade because he wore the uniform of the state. And my grandmother was a witness to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which is 174 girls flying like birds and falling down and dying. She turned right around, went to the Socialist Party headquarters, and eventually became Debs' personal secretary.
Eugene V. Debs, yeah. So your parents were left of center by a lot.
My parents were socialists and communists, and I was raised in a red community. I was a red diaper baby. And when I was about 11, I said to my father's friends, I get it. Your totalitarian psychopath is better than his totalitarian psychopath.
Did they like that?
No, but they didn't go crazy. They were heroes before I said it and after I said it.
You were talking about Stalin, obviously, among others. And do you think the left, including the far left, has come to recognize that Stalin, you know, was a monster?
No. The far left, if you ask them, like, they're against the blacklist. And I would say, would you work with a Nazi? And they all say, no. I said, well, that's called a blacklist. Mm-hmm. And that part of the left, I don't agree with. But I still honor them and their moral impulse.
Just develop that a little, Richard, if you would, for us. In other words, you honor them and their moral impulse because they were the left, because they were for good things, even though Joe Stalin was killing a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's only when Americans visited the Soviet Union that almost to a man, they stopped being supporters of the Soviet Union. And when George Orwell, as a leftist, went to Spain, and he realized that the communists were killing communists, he changed his political opinions basically to where I am. He became a centrist, and he would not support the far left or the right. And I think his writing about that is superb.
So we're talking with Richard Dreyfuss, and we have a little bit of background on where you come from and what makes you what you are. Let's start with your film career. How'd you get into it?
I was 9 years old, and I said to my mother, I want to be an actor, and she said, don't just talk about it. And I went down to the Jewish Community Center.
You were living in?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
We had moved to Los Angeles when I was nine. And so I walked down to the Jewish Community Center, and I then played every Jewish villain or hero, Theodor Herzl, Haman, and I was 10 years old. And one day my mother, who refused to recognize that the performance for the children was any different than the performance for the parents, walked on stage and said, Richard, fix your hair, in the middle of a performance. And I said to her once, why are you a socialist and not a communist? And she said, better donuts.
I love it. Better donuts. So you're there. You start to act in student performances. I should mention, for those who are listening who don't know who Haman is, he's the villain in the story of Queen Esther. Now, how did you graduate into the real thing?
I did a performance at Beverly Hills High School, and an agent called me and said that he wanted to represent me, but not until I graduated.
Now, a lot of people, famous people, went to Beverly Hills High School.
Yeah. Like or you. The children of famous people.
Yeah, okay.
But he did tell me about this one part, which I went and got. And so he started representing me when I was about 14.
Wow.
And he represented me for 20 years. And he was a real agent, of which there are none now. And he was a hustle. And he said something to me once, and I said, okay. And he looked at me and he said, why did you say okay? And I said, well, right now you're the smartest person in my life about my life. One day I'll be the smartest person in my life about my life. and I will not say okay all the time. And he said that's the right answer. So I did television for 11 years.
So you started with television.
Yeah, yeah. And I got a good reputation, but I turned down work, and I was thrown out of 20th, and I realized as I walked to my car that that feeling was just as good as the feeling you get when you get the part. So I started to turn down work a lot.
What were the ones you had on television? What were you doing?
I was Yossarian on the pilot of Catch 22. I was, I guess, comparable to Rob Reiner on a show that preceded All in the Family. And
you did Gunsmoke.
I did Gunsmoke, the first Jewish Gunsmoke. And I said the Shema on the Prairie.
I saw it. You were the guy who came into town, and the question was whether the bullies could run you out.
Yeah, I would say, go get him, Marshal.
These three men murdered my brother. Three of them, my father said, here they are.
Wait a minute, what are you talking about, boy? The men that killed your son?
Tell him, Papa. For God's sake, tell him, Marshal.
You've been incredibly successful as an actor, incredibly successful as an actor. What makes you able to do that?
Talent.
Well, I certainly believe that.
And luck and will. And I would walk in to a producer for a reading, and if the interview wasn't going very well, I would say, you know, this part I don't do well. Give me the script and I'll read it because I'm the best actor you're going to see. And they all had opinions about that. And one day my best friends sat me down and said, you're going to be blacklisted. You're not going to get anywhere with this kind of attitude. And I said, no, it's going to make me a star. How? They said. And I said, because they're going to say, well, let's see what he does with this. And that did make me a star.
We are incredibly lucky to have Richard Dreyfuss sitting here with us. But jumping ahead, was there ever a moment when you were blacklisted?
Never. And there isn't a blacklist on the right now at all, although they always say there is. But no, I was raised with socialists and guys who talk and guys who didn't.
Yeah.
So they were all on the same block. And I was very, very much aware of the politics of the 50s. And I remember saying to my mother, to my shame, I said, I am the luckiest kid in the world because I'm white, Jewish, and American. And she said, I think I'm going to let you stay in the meetings a little bit, because she gave me a political lesson. And I've been political since I was born.
Sure. You had a standing position when it came to the Academy Award, which was given to Ilya Kazan. Tell us about that.
Well, he was given the Life Achievement Award after winning 8 Oscars. And I said that giving him a Life Achievement Award was an endorsement of his moral character, of which he had none. And I said, it was said by Dreyfuss and Company that we were upset that he had an anti-communist career and like that. And I wrote, first in Atlantic Monthly, I wrote, I have to say thank you because you have done something unbelievable. I said, all of my life I have wanted to be named and you named me. Wow. And then I said,
name for those young people who are listening is when somebody pointed a finger at you and said communist.
Yeah. And what they did, Ilya Kazan was so hated by Henry Luce, the creator of Time, that when you opened the magazine that week, the miscellany column, which is usually buried in the center, was on the front page. And it said, in executive session yesterday at the Waldorf Astoria, Ilya Gadge Kazan named 226 names. Okay? Now, Ilya Kazan happened to be a serial betrayer, because when he wrote his autobiography, he tells by name all the wives of his best friends that he seduced. And they didn't know that until they read the book 30 years later, and guys on the Upper West Side looked up into the eyes of their wives, who had nothing to say. And that's what he did to the left. And he didn't deserve. I said that if I were there that night, I was going to be sitting on my hands.
Famously, a lot of people got up and turned around.
Yeah.
That night.
Yeah.
Okay, so you write this. You ever hear from Kazan after this?
Well, he was in his dotage by that time. He was brought out, and he really wasn't all there. But I had refused to shake his hand on a set. Dustin Hoffman was shooting, and he said, Gadge Kazan is coming today. And I went, let me out of here. And he came down, and I just said, hello.
Of all your moving pictures, which one is the most meaningful to you? I'm sure this is a question you've heard before.
And I always say...
I love all my children.
I love all... I always say I don't have a favorite. And those two or three that I didn't like, I'll never tell you which ones they are. So I had a career that I think is the most beautiful career ever.
Well, you still have it, don't you?
Not in the same way, no, because I stepped away and went to Oxford to learn the damage being done by the absence of teaching civics. And I felt that we are losing this country for specific reasons. We don't teach in the public schools anymore. And if you took Spanish, for instance, in your freshman year, there's absolutely no certainty that when you graduate 4 years later that you know any Spanish.
I'm living proof of that. Yes.
There you go. There you go. And they don't teach the birth of this country, which is the most beautiful birth story of any nation. And people in Europe know that we are a political miracle, but the kids don't know that because they're not taught it. They're not taught about civic authority, which is why in any paper in any city, you will see stories of crimes committed by corporations, office holders, anybody, and no stories about prosecution, indictment, and sending anybody up the river, because that is civic authority, the ability to hold people accountable.
Well, surely you exaggerate a little bit. You do see stories in the papers about guys who are convicted of crimes.
Not in that area, not in the area of finance or corporate crime, because now we believe once again in caveat emptor, let the buyer beware.
Let me ask you something. You didn't go to college, did you?
Oxford, I guess.
Well, yes. But when other kids were going to college, you didn't go.
No.
Has that psychologically been damaging to you?
Oh, no. During the years of college, I was a conscientious objector, and I worked for 2 years in L.A. County Hospital. And I believed that that was my obligation to the country.
Sure.
And only years later did I want to go to college. And I went. And I took classes and researched. I was a senior advisory member of St. Anthony's College at Oxford. And I kind of retired, although everyone said, don't ever use that word. And so I didn't.
Good. Let me ask you something. You're one of the brightest guys I know. But I know a lot of people who are incredibly bright. I mean, 40 years in the trenches as a college professor myself. I know a bunch of people who went through the School of Hard Knocks. They're brighter than anybody I know. You're one of them. And yet, sometime I get the feeling that they are feeling they should compensate for not having gone to college.
No, I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I'm a manic depressive, and I was in my manic state for about 50 years. And I could always turn something negative into a positive.
Sure.
So when I got bad grades, I turned it into, I don't want to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I dealt with my life. And I went from thrill to thrill until I was about 47, 48, and I had a divorce. And I shrank to the size of a spider with no self-esteem and stayed that way for about 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I had it coming.
Why you have it coming?
Because nothing bad ever happened to me, and I began to believe in the insane gods, two totally crazy gods who made sure nothing ever happened to me until I didn't expect it, and then they would bolt a lightning of cruelty or whatever, and I would react. And that didn't happen until my late 40s. And when I decided to go to Oxford and learn what I could and come back and teach, that's when I went through what my friends had gone through in their teens. uncertainty, disbelief, no guarantee that I would succeed. And that's now kind of part of my life.
Let's go back to the movies. Are there some movies, I know you love all your children or don't, and you're not telling us, but are there some...
My children, I worship.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about those children. I'm talking about your movie children. Okay, so are there some that you say, these are for the money, as opposed to these are for art?
The truth is, I never worked for money until I was 50. And then, because it was the only way I knew how to make a living, I began to take parts again. But I had been a star, and now I was doing three lines. And that hurt. And the whole idea of working for money, I had avoided my entire life. And I was now taking films like Piranha 3D and stuff like that. I once took a part in a pilot that was so terrible that when I looked up at the table reading into the eyes of the director, who was an old, perfectly professional guy, I looked up at him and he looked at me and he went, just wait. And I said to my wife, I said, sit down. If this show sells, I'll be dead in a year. And I burst into tears.
What was that about?
It was like, you know, naming names. It was like going against my character.
Sure.
And it was very, very personal because I'd never done that.
Everybody I've talked to excitedly and saying, guess who we're going to have on the air, Richard Dreyfuss? And they always say, ask about Jaws.
Burdum, burdum, burdum.
And what did you say the name of this shark is?
It's a Carcharodon carcharias. It's a great white.
Look, we depend on the summer people here for our very lives.
You are not going
and
to have
you
a summer
close those
unless
beaches,
you deal with this
problem.
We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark. I mean, we're going to have to tell the Coast Guard.
Mr. Vaughn, you have to contact the shark
we're going to have to put extra
panel.
Deputies on because
you have to ring this
world
entire
is come
harbor.
In here.
I don't think one of you are familiar with our problems.
I think that I am familiar with the fact that you are going to ignore this particular problem until it swims up and bites you on the ass.
There are more stories about Jaws than any film in the world, and the way I start is to say, when I got into the film, there was no cast, no script, no shark, nothing. And it was, oddly enough, without anyone realizing it, the first time anyone had attempted to make a film in the real ocean. And boy, was that a mistake. And so the shark would come up and go, whoa, whoa. And all over the island, we had radio mics.
And where was this?
Martha's Vineyard. And you could hear, walking down the street, the shark is not working. The shark is not working. And one day you heard, the shark is working. The shark is working. The boat is sinking. The boat is sinking, and I was on that boat. And the anchor had been ripped out, and the boat wrangler was trying desperately to get it into the island of Chappaquiddick. And Robert Shaw decided that if he was going to drown, he wanted to drown neatly. And so he stepped into the bow of the boat, and he, you know, buttoning his buttons and making sure his hat was correct. Meanwhile, Steven Spielberg is on a megaphone saying, get the actors off the boat, get the actors off the boat. And there was a 70-year-old sound man with a $50,000 Nagra on his lap, and I'm helping him get his legs over the boat. And there were 6-foot swells.
Yeah.
And I was helping this guy, and Steven said, get the actors off the boat. And I said, Steven, he's 70 years old. I can't say what he said. Bleep him. Get the actors off the boat.
I love it. So even though some people would see the movie as, you know, sort of typical Hollywood, you would say it had a real importance.
Well, because it wasn't typical. It was the first blockbuster. And then they created the blockbuster distribution thing. And a couple of years ago, there was an article on the front page of the New York Times that said they're running out of blockbuster themes, meaning audiences would react to it everywhere. And now we have to go back, make films about Kansas, and hope that they like it in Nigeria. And that's going to happen.
Let's talk about the one I like the most, which you'll probably think is very naive of me, but Mr. Holland, because, you know, I had a teacher who was Mr. Holland. I think a lot of people did.
It was a magical shoot. Everyone fell in love with everyone. We did scenes like the last scene that I'm conducting in front of that big audience.
Right, right.
At least 10 times just because we love doing it.
Really?
Really.
This is a time when it all comes together. They're honoring you by playing the music you've written.
Yeah.
Mr. Holland, we would now like to give something back to you. To you and to your wife, who along with you has waited 30 years for what we're about to hear. If you will, would you please come up here and take this baton and lead us in the first performance ever of the American Symphony by Glenn Holland.
How do you do that? I mean, what do you say to the director? Let's do it again?
He wanted to do it too.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. In the 70s, I would say, I would have played the character Elliot Garfield from The Goodbye Girl forever.
I'm not crazy about the arrangements.
You're not.
Definitely not. I'm paying the rent. I will make it a rules. I like to take showers every morning, and I don't like the panties drying on the rod. I like to cook, so I will use the kitchen whenever I damn well please. And I am very particular about my condiments, so keep your salt and pepper to yourself. Plus, I play the guitar in the middle of the night whenever I cannot sleep, and I meditate every morning, complete with chanting and burning incense, so if you've got to walk around, I'd appreciate a little tiptoeing. Also, I sleep in the nude.
But now, after Mr. Holland, I would say I'd play Mr. Holland.
I'm giving up the clarinet. I'm just goofing everybody else up anyway.
You know what we've been doing wrong, Miss Lang? We've been playing the notes on the page.
Well, what else is there to play?
Well, there's a lot more to music than notes on a page. Let me ask you a question.
What?
When you look in the mirror, what do you like best about yourself?
My hair.
Why?
My father always says that it reminds him of a sunset.
Play the sunset. One, two, three, four.
Did you have a music teacher who was like Mr. Holland?
No, I had great teachers, but not music, until I did the competition, which is a story of a piano competition.
Sure.
And I had a master pianist who I watched for 6 months.
Really?
Because I said, you're never going to teach me how to play.
No.
So I'm an actor, and I watched her play, and we knew to the millisecond every part of the Emperor Concerto by Beethoven. And then I started to mimic her. And if the piano had been my playing, it would sound like the earthquake.
Sure.
But I was finger on. And the other night, I visited a friend, and she went to see it with Pincus Zukerman.
Indeed.
And he said, I can't believe it. This kid is finger perfect. And that was one of the proudest things I ever did.
Wow.
And the most amazing thing about that film is that I aged from 30 to 60, and no one could see it.
Yeah.
The makeup was so subtle that it wasn't even nominated for Best Makeup that year. And it's an amazement to me, because you can't tell how that was done. So,
what's it like to be a star on a picture? How are you treated? Do the co-stars treat you deferentially because you're the star? Take us inside.
The thing about being a star is that you have the power to knock on the writer's door and go into that meeting.
Say, let's change this.
Yeah. And what people take as deference is actually efficient money management. Meaning, if you say to someone, I'm going to go get a cup of coffee, they say, no, I'll get it, because you might spill the coffee on your costume.
Or because they want to kiss your behind.
No.
Okay.
And if they say, if you do something that might muss your hair, the hairdresser goes nuts and takes care of the hair. So during the day, you are treated like a prince. And then it's up to you to believe that you are or not. And I would go home and my wife would say, take out the garbage. And I would say, moi?
Sure.
Me?
Sure, you know? I understand this.
And also another thing. You're walking down Broadway. A woman is coming this way. She doesn't turn her head. She nothing until she passes me, and I don't see it. And she turns around and goes, like that. But I don't see it. So I don't have that feeling of being a star. I have to be reminded of it all the time.
So one privilege, just to prolong this a little bit, one privilege is that because of the money, people treat you deferentially, you know, on set and the rest. But do you ever get into arguments with the way other people are playing their roles?
Arguments, no. Sometimes I'll say to an actor, why don't you try it like that?
And really?
Yeah, and directors go nuts. But
when you say they go nuts, what do they do? That's it. They say, this is my job?
Yeah. Exactly. As a matter of fact, one of my first jobs was in a show at Universal Studios, and I had four lines. And the actor I was doing the scene with went up. He dried, and he didn't remember the line.
Dried meaning he forgot his lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I went, cut. And
Oh, boy.
The director walked over to me and pointed his finger in my chest hard and said, you don't do that. I do that. And then I was about that big and I crawled out. The best thing about being a star is the power. And in on every film, there's a different power structure.
So give us an example of a film or a couple of films that had a power structure that you were interested in.
Mr. Holland.
Okay.
Or
and Mr. Holland, how much power did you have?
Well, they wouldn't do something that I didn't like. They wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And actors are surprisingly bright.
Yeah.
Because they recognize human behavior. And if an actor says he wouldn't do that, listen to him. So Mr. Holland or Once Around or The Tin Man or...
What about Bob with Bill Murray?
Well, I was a gorilla, but he was a bigger gorilla. And he was also a putz, so I didn't like it.
6 o'clock, Bob. Time to wake up. Come on, let's go. Come on, Bob. Get up. Bob. Come on, Bob. Bob, rise and shine. Come on. Bob. Come on, Bob, get up. Bob. 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 Get up. Come on. Come on, it's 6 o'clock. Rise and shine, rise and shine. Anna, go get the car right now. Come on, Bob. Come on. Bob. 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 Cop. Ka-do-do-do!
What didn't you like about him?
He was a bully.
Bullies aren't good.
Yeah. And I'm saying that in public.
Sure.
So he'll say something in public.
Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, he will.
Okay, so he was a bully. And what happened?
Really, what happened was that we finished the film and I never talked to him again. And that was that. I also did a film with Oliver Stone, who yelled at me and said, you are the worst actor I have ever worked with. You have killed my show. I am having to rewrite and re-edit this film because of you. And you overact. You never say that to an actor. And
did he hire you? Did he put you on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. He hired me like this. I walked in the door. And before I put my behind on the couch, he said, you look really old. And I looked in the mirror and I said, I think I look bitchin'. But I don't work for anything but money. You got money? He said, no. I said goodbye and walked out. But I needed the money, so I did. I played Dick Cheney.
You want to know what I see, Mr. President? I see a world where in about 25 years, America's reserves are gone. 80% of the world's future energy reserves are right here in Eurasia, where the prize ultimately lies. Oil, gas, water. Control Iran, control Eurasia, control the world. Empire. Real empire.
And he yelled at me, and he kept yelling, and I said, you have made a strategic error, Oliver. What's that? The press junket is yet to come. And sure enough, the LA Times stood up and said, Richard, what do you think about this film? Oliver is sitting next to me, and I looked at him and smiled. And then I said, well, if the film had been made 5 or 6 years ago, it would have had some meaning. But since Oliver took all of the politics out and replaced that with a relationship with his father, which didn't really exist, there's no real reason to go and see this film.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Don't they write that stuff into your contract that you can't do it?
No. His partner said I shouldn't do it. And he called my agent and said, you better tell Richard to stop this. We are going for an Oscar campaign. And she said,
you mean for Richard?
Yeah. And she said, the worst actor you've ever worked with?
Really?
Go bleep yourself, and hung up the phone. And when his partner came to talk to me, I opened up the door and he said, he thinks salt. You know, he just does that. And he is. Bleep.
Oh, God. So do you think it's possible that when a director says that kind of thing to you, that in their own mind they think they're going to get more out of you that way?
No. I always say to a director at the beginning, I work best in a relaxed and creative atmosphere. And everyone wants that, and we do. And Oliver didn't give a hoot in hell. And he makes his film the way he wants to. And I didn't do what he wanted me to do.
Well, I'll get into as much trouble as you just got into. I'll say, when I hear the name Richard Dreyfuss, I say, boy, what an actor. When I hear the name Oliver Stone, then I think the same thing that got bleeped before. I don't see the same credibility for the man that I see for you in terms of your product and your acting.
Let me tell you, I did a show called Cop Shop.
Yep.
And Cop Shop is the best writing I have ever worked with. And it was about the lives of cops, but not crime. You know, their domestic problems. And they were shot as one act from the beginning to the end in one take. And my segment was, I was a whoremonger who was a year sober.
But you were a cop.
And I was second in the hierarchy of the New York Police Department. And I'm let in, and Rita Moreno was at that point announcing what she was going to buy on her shopping list, which I can't say on this show. And then I sat down and listened to all the prostitutes talking, and I didn't move a muscle for about a half hour. And then I picked Rosie Perez. We walked back to this room, and I said, the thing is, I'm shy, and I want to get to know someone. And we started talking about being lapsed Catholics. And then as I'm on screen, I took my clothes off. And at that moment, two corrupt cops come in and say, you're ours, you pay me by the month. Mm-hmm. And I heard that, and I just walked out in my underwear, and I said, excuse me, I just want to get my clothes, so I'm sorry. And I flashed my badge, and they puked. They just went insane and dropped on the couch. And I said, I'll give you 1 minute to get out of here before I skin you. And they left. And Rita turned to me and said, well, I guess we're yours now. And I said, no, you don't have to. No, she says, no, we'll pay you monthly. And at that moment, the girls were putting the chairs around, and it was a 12-step program, and they were in it. They were as sober as I was, and they announced their names. And because it was a 12-step program, they had to announce their real names. So they weren't Tiffany and Heather. They were Myrtle and Joan.
Gertrude.
And PBS. Dick Cheney took Pat Mitchell into his office and said,
Pat Mitchell at PBS.
Head of PBS.
And Dick Cheney didn't like what was happening, right?
And he was the vice president of the United States.
Right.
Just thought I'd.
And probably the most powerful vice president of the United States
ever,
we have ever seen.
Ever. Yeah. At least until the second term. Yeah. And then he says, this is what's going to happen. We're going to lift your license, and you'll have to get it back in court, and it'll cost you $500,000. So we were bleeped. Certain words were bleeped.
They played the program, but they bleeped certain words.
Yeah. And there was a press thing, and my partner David talked for about 5 minutes, and the people from PBS talked for 5 minutes. And
your partner, meaning that you were producing this thing?
No, I was just acting in it, but I was my producer's best friend.
Okay, gotcha.
And when I started to speak, I said, this is not a soundbite, ladies and gentlemen. Sit down. And everyone sat down, and when I said that, my partner went, oh, my God, he's going to talk too much. And I talked for about 20 minutes. And then we were covered in 102 newspapers, and we got a best pick of the year in about 70.
About the program.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they dropped it and wouldn't put it on. And
PBS dropped it because you yapped.
No, PBS dropped it because it got bleeped, meaning it was going to continue getting bleeped.
Yeah.
And that they had passed it. You know, they had said yes. And it wasn't until Chaney stepped in as a stormtrooper and they backed off.
Amazing. Have you ever had reason to think about Chaney since that time? Right now we're watching him with his daughters. He's gotten himself into a mess because one daughter's a lesbian, the other one is running for the Senate as a right-winger, said that she's not an advocate of gay marriage. Based on that earlier experience, do you think he's getting off light on this thing? Because I do.
Well, of course he's getting light. He's not up the river in prison for 90 years. But history will not remember anything about his gay daughters. They will remember that he and his president were the worst administration in the history of the country and have done more damage to what the Constitution means than anyone else.
What other movie do you think had a philosophical impact that you've been in? Mr. Holland was great because it really did speak to the travesty of ending orchestras. I'll tell you, all my music in my life comes from Mr. Steiker, my Mr. Holland. What other movies can you think of that had that kind of impact that we should all recognize?
I believe that there are no happy endings now. I think Advice and Consent was the last political novel that reflected reality. And now it's blowing up the White House and stealing the president's daughter. Or it's mechanical monsters coming from the deep ocean. And we have no sense of appropriate villainy or appropriate heroes. And we need heroes and we need villains prosecuted and sent up the river. And I was once stopped by a federal prosecutor who introduced himself as, "I'm a Republican federal prosecutor and I'm going to put some bad people in jail." And I said, "Do it. We need it." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "We need heroes and we need villains prosecuted. But the kids are not taught that they are sovereign in their power. They are the highest power. And they don't know that because it's not taught."
Do you think Barack Obama is doing a good job?
Well, he will be remembered as doing something that was impossible for the last 100 years. And I believe that when he passed health care, and it started with glitches and falling apart and everyone's yelling and screaming, World War II started badly, and so did Social Security, and so did the highway system, and every national endeavor starts badly. And what you do is a Congress of both parties gets together and fixes it. We are living in the worst political conflict since the years before the Civil War. And there are people who simply don't accept the fact that the president was elected president. And
absolutely right.
I believe that the Constitution should be central and the political parties should be peripheral. And I...
Well, is that naive of you to think that that's ever going to happen considering what's going on right now?
Well, if I didn't believe it, I wouldn't have talked so far to 176,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that sooner or later, there are going to be people joining me and speaking to it because everyone, left and right, feels the swirling decay down the toilet. And I have asked people, when you think of the future of the country, do you feel comfortable and easy, or do you feel uneasy and discomforted? And 175,999 people have said uneasy.
And they're saying it in the polls every time we look at a poll.
And that saying it in the poll is going to be the foundation. People are going to realize that their feeling of that unease is a betrayal of their children. And our kids, or our kids' kids, will say something that has never before been said. They're going to turn to us and say, "How could you have abandoned us like this?" Because we're not teaching entrepreneurship and roll them bones risk. And we're not teaching anything that the Enlightenment gave to the beginning of the country. We told 98% of the human race who had been left out of the tale. And if you learned how to write or read, they cut your fingers off. We said, if you can get here, you get all of that. You can read, write, do sums. You can move without asking anyone's permission. You can start endeavors and either fail or not. And if you succeed, you get the reward. And that's why people came here.
What's the Dreyfus Initiative?
The Dreyfus Initiative is what I just said, put into a nonprofit form. And I speak all over the country. And in the middle of speaking, I discovered, or should have discovered earlier, that education is always in the hands of the state, not the federal government. So you can tell the federal government to go jump in a lake. And when I spoke to the Burroughs Organization in Pennsylvania, I said, there is more power in this room than in all of the federal government. You write curriculum, you personally in this room. The buck stops here. And I said, you have to do this because your children are being cheated out of participating in a political miracle that the whole world knows about except our kids.
Do you have enough money?
I have no money.
How did that happen? Star in all these shows, you get residuals, you know, it must be something to turn a television on and watch a movie that you've starred in.
Well, in a phrase?
Yeah.
I'm an idiot when it comes to money.
But didn't you have somebody who was looking, working with you and saying, I want to save you some money, Richard?
Only people who stole from me.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know it.
Yeah.
So I didn't even look at how much I had until it was gone.
How do you support yourself?
I support myself by speaking about civics, about speaking about manic depression or Israel or like that. And I make a living, but not like it used to be. There are only five guys who make that kind of money, myth money, and everyone else makes nothing. And that's true. If you watched the documentary about the Cannes Film Festival, Spike Jonze doesn't get the money anymore. And that's amazing to me. And I'm not involved in this business anymore. Los Angeles is one of the worst. It's not one of the worst. It's the worst city in the world because they have no sophisticated sneer like New York and D.C., and because it's true that if you work for 3 years, you can make $1 billion. And when that's true, hold on to your soul, because you will one day be found holding a bloody knife over the body of your mother. And so I got out of there.
I'm not sure what that last thing meant about the bloody knife over your mother.
It means that they would betray every principle they have for money.
Once you're sucked in.
Yeah, and you get sucked in on the third day. I mean, it's a pretty sick place.
Right. You're very proud of your children. You said so before.
Yes, I think I have the greatest children in the world. My eldest daughter is fantastic and articulate, and she was working for CNET. Oh, she is working for CNET on an on-air show. My son, Ben, is the most acutely knowledgeable political observer in the world. And my youngest, Harry, is an actor to whom I said, after watching Iago and Molière, I said, I've never said this before, but you're better than me.
How do we know? How did he know that you were not just filled with pride as opposed to being objective?
Well, because first of all, he knew me.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, his older brother and sister thought that because I was a star, they were going to be stars. And I said, it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter said at one point when she was really young, would you be upset if I became a serious actress? And I said, you'll become a serious actress when you don't ask my permission. And now she doesn't have that ambition anymore. And Ben works as an editor of Mother Jones magazine, and he just got a promotion, and he's moving to New York. And they are, when I became a father, I discovered that there are wonderful things in the world, money, success, whatever, all within the bounds of the known universe. But when you become a father, you find out that there are certain loves that are wider, higher, and greater than the known universe. And you know it's true that you'll take a bullet for your kids.
Without question.
That's right. I started on the left, and now I'm a centrist. And when people say in Hollywood, you are a member of the gaggle of Hollywood liberals, I have two things to say. I gaggle for no one, and I am not a liberal. I am a libo, conservo, rado, middle of the rodo. Just like you, but you haven't thought about it lately. People who don't change their politics since they're 12 need therapy. I speak for those who have an open mind about the Constitution. I have Republican heroes and Democratic heroes and Democratic villains and Republican villains.
Who's the Republican hero?
The guy who prosecuted Dick Cheney's chief of staff.
Libby.
That was a heroic thing, and he didn't anticipate that he would get a complete washout. And he wasn't guilty on the record, but he was guilty of sin. And what he was guilty of was not only outing
Valerie Plame
and a covert agent. He killed 49 people in Europe because she was outed, and nothing was ever said about that.
Following up on that for one second, I wanted to ask you about these folks who were giving out huge amounts of data from Americans that Americans don't know about. You've been an advocate of education, but how can we be good citizens if we don't get that stuff?
My answer is disliked by everybody, but I believe, like the nuclear club, that you can get into the nuclear club when you have the power to make one. And you get into the nuclear club and a third world country gets immediate help from the World Bank and all the other financial institutions. I believe that you can stop the data from coming down like you can stop the waves from coming in. So I'm for total transparency. I think all the data should be given to all the countries. They have the same reason as we do that they're vulnerable to terrorists. And I say, as soon as a country can say that they will not do A, B, C, and D, they should get the information because they are as vulnerable as we are.
So, Richard, what do you want to leave us with?
I want people to know that the DreyfusInitiative.org needs money, and it needs money from people in the United States. It needs money so I can talk to people. It needs money because I started an American history play competition among all the regional theaters of the country, and I have to find money to support that. I started civic clubs in parks, and this is a necessity because within our lifetime or a little bit later, there will be no America. There will be no United States of America. And I don't want that. I want my kids to have all the freedoms that I had. And I take it personally.
Clearly, and I admire you for it. Our guest has been Richard Dreyfuss. He's the Academy Award-winning actor. I don't have to tell you that. Richard, again, thanks so much for taking time to be here with us today. It's been a wonderful hour. It went awfully quickly. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us some more at some point. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thank you.
Would you please come up here and take this baton and lead us in the first performance ever of the American Symphony by Glenn Holland?
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.